Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of T Watches a Scary Movie. Tonight's episode is going to be part two of my interview with horror personality Heather Wixon. We're going to be discussing her new book, In Search of Darkness. We're going to talk about indie horror and some of the directors that have helped to push indie horror out in recent years. And of course, we're going to talk some great old school horror movies, folks. So if you have not seen part one, I got the link up in the corner for you to access now. It'll be available at the end of this episode as well, too. And don't forget, part three of this interview is going to be coming out tomorrow. So if you've not listened to the other ones, make sure you go check out part one and make sure you come back, check out the conclusion of this interview that's going to be coming out tomorrow. But either way, here's part two of my interview with Heather Wixon. Enjoy. Curious, because I love the fact that you mentioned like the VHS boom as well, and you know, the way that video stores really kind of built that up. You know, there's a lot of talk about streaming these days and about, like, you know, what it's doing to the film industry, and there's merits on both sides of that. But I feel that when it comes to horror, especially, it almost seems a lot like the VHS days of the late 80s, early 90s, because especially in the world of indie horror, it's giving all these other films like a chance to be seen and a chance to thrive. And I'm curious if, you know, for all the negativity that's out there about streaming right now, how you feel about it when it comes to horror.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I always see there's sort of the streaming versus physical media conversation. It's endless. It's like, oh, it's been 3 days, let's have this conversation again. But so I think for me, like, I'm somebody who's always going to appreciate physical media, but I also enjoy what streaming does for accessibility, because it doesn't mean, like, these days it's not like we can go into, like, a lot of people don't have access to video stores. That's just not a thing. Like, I live in LA, so I'm lucky, so we have sort of these fun niche, you know, video store experiences. Like Vidiots recently reopened last year, and they were able to do a video store as part of, like, their setup. But I know somebody in Oklahoma doesn't have that same thing, where in the 80s they did. So for me, like, getting people more access, I don't think is a bad thing. Like, I do see, like, we're all sort of oversubscribed to things at this point, like, where it's like, we did this because we were trying to get away from cable. Now we're all spending way more than we ever were on cable, because we're like, we're on Max, we're on, you know, Paramount, we're on, you know, Netflix, we're Hulu, all this. So I think for me, one of the things that I do think is really cool, though, is that you get stuff like Tubi, and like having access to that kind of a library for free is really amazing. And I can't hate on that, because, like, there are so many times where, like, I have to watch some weird, obscure movie. It's out of print on disc. It's not available to purchase through other means. I'll find it on Tubi, though. Like, I had to, like, years ago, I had to watch Santa with Muscles, which is this really terrible, yet I love it, but it's terrible, like, Christmas movie with Hulk Hogan as Santa. You know, which, of course, Hulk Hogan himself is already a complicated topic as it is, you know. But at the same time, I was like, okay, well, what am I going to do? It's not on Amazon. What, how am I going to find this? It was on Tubi. So I do think, like, it's very short-sighted to think it's an either or situation, because I don't think it is. But I do think that there is something inherently messed up about what's going on with streaming these days. And I think a lot of the streaming services are starting to see the fall off where, like, yeah, we were all really eager to subscribe to these things, but guess what? Like, existing is now three times more expensive than it was, like, 5 years ago. Yeah. Like, so people are going to have to start making cuts. That's why you're seeing, I think it's like, they're talking about, like, merging HBO and Paramount, which, I mean, honestly, for me, that'd be cool. Because what I like, it, like, you know, as much as, like, you want to hate on streaming services, what's cool about Max is, like, you get access to Turner Classic Movies on there too. So it's not just like the big movies that they're putting out, like Wonka or Aquaman. Like, you're getting to go into And like find like older movies that again may not be as accessible. Like I was working on a project and I had to find Brian De Palma's Sisters, which is a fantastic movie. Really, really love that one a lot. And it was on HBO Max because of Turner Classic Movies. I'm not going to find that on Netflix. I'm not going to find that, you know, I don't think it was on Tubi either because it's a little bit like artsy kind of weird stuff. And so, you know, it's like, I never want to say either or. I get it though, because there are times where like, I'll go to look to stream something just because it's easy. I'm on the couch, my dogs are sleeping on me and I don't want to move and it's not available. And I'm like, oh, now I have to go get my disc, you know? So it's the lazy factor too. But like at the same time, like I know for somebody who's like, you know, living paycheck to paycheck and they just want to keep up on fun horror movies or watch this or that or discover old ones, like having access to things like Pluto TV or Tubi is a godsend. Like honestly, like we, because of COVID, like when COVID hit and everything was shutting down and like we were like, okay, well we have to make major cuts across the board, so we like we turned off like TV stuff. Pluto TV was like our go-to for 8 months straight because it was like specific channels for specific things. I love watching old game shows, so that like really hit me. I was like, I can almost like after watching it for weeks and weeks and weeks, I could pretty much tell you the entire run of like how the Addams Family like worked out because like I was just watching that channel all the time. And they have movies too. So like I think there's a really sort of fine line between understanding the importance of physical media, because it always is going to be important. You know, as we see, you know, more and more studios like either not putting new movies out on release or doing a very limited thing and then oops, that's it. But also being able to give more people the opportunity to discover movies through streaming. And I also think too, like having something like Shudder, you know, has made a huge difference in terms of independent horror, because in like the 2010s, you know, before Shudder even existed, if you were an independent horror movie, good luck making noise, good luck finding an audience, because there wasn't, like, you just had to go on straight onto like regular VOD, buy it on demand, that was that. Yeah. So in that regard, like things like Shudder or Screambox that became sort of these champions of more diverse movies, again, is a really good thing. So, you know, I will never be an either or, but I get it both ways. But also too, like there is something about holding something in your hand and knowing you own it and somebody can't take that away from you too.
I love your answers because like I feel like you're feeding right into like all these other questions that I have, because I literally was gonna ask you something.
We're in sync.
Totally in sync right now. And, you know, I love the fact that you talk so much about indie horror because, you know, we're in a world of high-profile remakes, reboots, sequels, but we're also getting movies like Skidamarink, like The Outwaters, like We're All Going to the World's Fair, Watcher, and they show that indie horror is thriving just as well as, you know, mainstream horror, if you want to use that name. And I know you have such a passion for the independent scene. Why is it important for folks to not just be checking to not just check out the high profile new sequel, reboot, franchise starter that's out in theaters, but also to check out just as many indie horror flicks as well too?
You know, I think for me it's always been because like it's real, like I mean, also admittedly right now we're getting studios taking a little more risks with their movies, so that's kind of cool. But like I know, again, when I was sort of really kind of carving out my niche in sort of the online journalism space, there were so many people who just, because it wasn't a title that was going to give them like the clicks that they were looking for, it wasn't like the high profile things that like people were like, oh, here's 15 different articles bagging on the Nightmare on Elm Street remake. Okay, cool. We get it. But like, that wasn't interesting to me. And I, because as somebody who grew up loving so many different like independent film houses, like we don't have a Nightmare on Elm Street under a studio system. We have a Nightmare on Elm Street because Bob Shaye basically leveraged all of the money that he had made through distribution in the 80s to give Wes Craven like $1.1 million to go make a Nightmare on Elm Street. And then they did a subsequent like indie rollout for it. You know, it wasn't a big studio movie back then. So to me, the indies, like, again, I think it sort of feeds also into the horror genre. It's a genre for underdogs, right? And I love a good underdog story. And so for me, especially like being so fortunate to live in LA and getting to go to different film festivals and seeing what filmmakers in the independent space were doing, I was like, there's like some really cool stuff out here. Like, why aren't we talking about this more? And that was honestly one of the reasons in 2011, it was like a weird sort of convergence of circumstances where like, I was working a day job. I was actually working at a special effects shop. I ended up getting shingles. It was like weird. Like my partner, his mom had just passed away. I got shingles. My boss decided to fire me. I was kind of laid out for months. It was just like, I need something to do with my time. And I was like, and then I was kind of seeing like the boss that I was working for at Dread Central, even though he was like, oh, I'm Mr. Independent Horror, he was not. Because I had to constantly fight with him about making sure that we were covering these titles. And I was like, okay, fine. You don't want to do this. What if I create Indie Horror Month and make it into a thing? Because I was like, there should be something out there that like is championing these folks who are like the next wave of filmmakers. And one of those people ended up being Mike Flanagan, because he came to us with Absentia when it was the second year of Indie Horror Month. So that would have been 2012. And he was like, hey, like I got this movie. And I was totally blown away. And I was like, this guy is going to do something. I just knew it like in my heart, like this guy loves horror. Like there's something here that like he's going to do some shit. Like that was like my thing. I don't know if I can swear. So I did that very soft. And so for me, that was like the coolest thing ever, was like getting to sort of see this side of the genre where people were taking risks, who were really making movies with their friends, and you feel that passion and you see people coming at it with new ideas. Because studio horror is really cool right now. It wasn't that cool in the early 2010s, that's for sure. Yeah. And I think a lot of what you're seeing now is a response to that. Like one of the biggest movies to kind of come along that sort of changed things was Insidious. That was totally independent because Blumhouse at that point wasn't Blumhouse as we know it. Like that was a huge risk for them at that point. And that was basically James Wan and Lee Whannell having to totally like reset their careers because of the responses, which were totally wrong, to movies like Death Sentence or Dead Silence, two movies that I personally love.
Oh, they're so good.
It's funny because I would get to interview James like a bunch of times like after that, and I'd always fight with him over like, dude, Dead Silence rules. And he's like, no, it's okay. You don't have to be nice. And I'm like, I'm not being nice. Mary Shaw is great, you know? Mm-hmm. So getting to sort of see a lot of these folks kind of coming into this space, it's just like ridiculously cool. And you've got these guys now that are like in charge of huge movies. Like Adam Wingard is a guy who basically, I think Popsicle was made for like $5,000. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I got to interview him was 2011. It was for A Horrible Way to Die. I think we actually did include that in our first Indie Horror Month celebration. And like, the dude just put out a huge Godzilla Kong movie. Like, yeah. Oh my God. You know, so getting to see that kind of stuff is so amazing. And like another one for me, I was really fortunate in 2013. I got to actually do like a little festival at a movie theater because I used to go back to Chicago to co-host Flashback Weekend there. And Mike, who runs Flashback Weekend, he works with like a theater chain, and they had a theater out here in LA. And he was like, hey, if you ever want a theater for a weekend, let me know. And I was like, really? Like, when do you get that kind of opportunity? And it was a pure labor of love. I was just like, okay, who's got movies? What movies have I seen recently that I love that I want to put on a big screen? Mm-hmm. You know, let's make some space for some shorts. Let's do like have some fun. And that was like one of the greatest feelings ever. Like every time I would walk in a theater and a new movie was on the big screen, I got emotional. And it was such a cool feeling to be able to kind of give a lot of folks who may not have gotten that opportunity the chance to get it. And then also too, for me personally, because one of the movies that really gave me like that oh feeling when I was watching stuff on the independent side of things was Resolution from Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead. Mm-hmm. And I knew when I did this, I was like, I need to put resolution on a big screen. I was like, this blew my mind. It changed my DNA a lot. And I knew immediately from that movie, like anything these guys do, I'm watching, like I'm in 100%. And I still think about like that experience. And it wasn't like a huge crowd, cause it was like Saturday night. Like it was really hard to kind of promote it as it was. But we worked really hard. I did it by myself. Like it was a total labor of love. I've got nothing out of it except getting to give people a place to sort of show their stuff. And I will tell you, like, the greatest feeling for me was after Resolution finished. And there was like this couple that came out and they bought tickets on a whim. They hadn't even been to any of the other movies. Mm-hmm. They just happened to be like, oh, let's go see a movie. Oh, what is this Resolution? And they watched it and they were like, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Oh, this is awesome.
And they were like, we're gonna go look up the other movies, because is it all like this? And I just, like, I don't know whatever happened to them. They weren't horror people. They just kind of showed up on a whim. And I was like, I was so excited. I was like, oh my God, like that's the cool feeling. And I love, like, for me, that was the greatest sort of gift back to me in this space, was when I could like talk about something that I genuinely love. And somebody would be like, oh, you know, I watched this movie because of you and thank you. Or like, you know, that was really cool. Now I'm going to go watch this. Like, I just love that feeling, because I certainly was never in this for the money, you know, getting to hear from people who, like, I might've just turned them on to something that they may not have seen otherwise is like the coolest thing ever. Yeah. And that's, you know, that was what I loved. And so like, as I was driving home that night, because Resolution was like the last movie we showed, and I just like got super emotional. I was thinking about it. I was like, that was so cool. Like somebody's, I don't want to say life, but somebody's like experience change because they got to see this movie that they never would have seen otherwise. Like, that's rad.
And, you know, you talk about like that, that's such an awesome experience, getting to curate something like that and to like just to put together an experience, because it really is an experience that somebody's honestly going to take away for like the rest of their life, because obviously, again, that's something that they would have never seen any other way. And, you know, you set that experience up. And that makes me want to go back to, you know, the book, In Search of Darkness. How do you guys curate that list? Like, how do you get that down to choose just the entries that you have in the book? Because, I mean, it, you know, it's one thing for you know, the documentary. You got to do, like, multiple parts for that. But how do you narrow that down to this book with the entries that you include into it?
That's a good question, and I wish I had a more fancy answer, but honestly, it just came down to the movies that were featured in volume 1 and 2 of the doc. Because we actually started this like a few years ago before part 3 had actually gone into production. And so basically it was like, here's a list of 142 movies. I think there was a point where we thought we were going to add in 3, and we realized, no, we got to just deliver this thing. We just got to birth the baby and get on with it. Because it was a huge undertaking. And so it was just kind of that. But I think what was cool about it was, like, I think a lot of folks have asked, like, okay, so the documentaries exist, why would I want the book, right? And I get it. I totally get it. It's not a cheap book. I'm a horror fan on a budget too. So like, why would I want this book on top of being able just to watch the documentaries whenever? And for me, what I really wanted this to be was turning it into an extension. Like, it's almost like the director's cut of the first 2 In Search of Darkness documentaries, because like, you're kind of limited in a way with those docs, where like, you can't go 20 minutes on every movie. You have to kind of get in there, get, you know, kind of do what you need to do and get out to get onto the next movie. Otherwise you're going to have a 10-hour doc. Yeah. So for me, what I didn't want to do anything that had already been done in the doc when we were writing. And I purposefully, doing research and doing everything, like, I didn't go back and watch the docs at all, because I didn't want to be repetitive, which then ultimately ended up biting me in the butt, because I ended up being repetitive in Night of the Comet, because I was actually going back to an interview that I had done with the director and Kelly Maroney for Night of the Comet. I was like, oh, I'm going to share this fun story. And then legitimately, when they brought us the quotes that are featured in the book, from the doc. It's literally like verbatim a story in that section. I was like, oh, I was like, we don't have any other quotes. And they were like, no. And I was like, okay, well, I'm not editing my chapter because that's going to throw everything off. We're past that at this point. But yeah, I just wanted to give people a little more context, a little more backstory, a little more perspective. For me, the book is about context, about what was going on in the 80s. You know, why were these movies happening the way they are? Like, if you look at like what horror was in 1980 versus 1984, you can see a clear trajectory away from, again, sort of that high level studio stuff with like The Changeling or Ghost Story, you know, which were like in response to like stuff like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Rosemary Baby, like The Exorcist, The Omen, where you're kind of getting into more like pop culture kind of stuff and things like that. So yeah, I just kind of wanted to never the intention of redoing the doc, but just taking it a little further and giving people a little more. Especially for the people who came to In Search of Darkness, who may not have really known much about the 80s horror movies that were happening at the time. Like, you know, honestly, like, as much as I'm like older and stuff, like, this is a great book for somebody in their 20s. Like, it might seem intimidating to go back. In fact, I do actually have a coworker who because our parent company is in Japan, and he actually just moved to New York to be with his wife from Japan. And he's like always asking me about like, oh, tell me more about American horror. What should I watch? Where should I start? So then when I was like on work Slack and I was like, hey guys, guess what? The book that I've been working on is going up for pre-order. He pre-ordered it because one, he didn't have to bug me about like trying to give him recommendations anymore. Cause I'm just like, well, what do you like? Like, are you looking for funny? Are you looking for scary? Are you looking for this or that? Like I could give you 20 different movies and they could be totally different things. So he's been actually kind of going through it and really learning a lot about stuff that he had no access to when he was younger. So yeah, I think there's like, I wanted the book to be accessible enough for somebody who maybe doesn't know a lot about the genre, but also a really great in-depth celebration for people who've been watching this stuff their entire lives. And it was a really tough line to walk. And I never wanted, like, even movies that I wasn't super passionate about, I never wanted to phone it in for that. Because they still deserved to be celebrated and recognized. And I know Patrick did the same thing. You know, I made sure, because I got to be able to be the one who sort of divvied up who took on which movies. Mm-hmm. And I know what Patrick is passionate about. I know where his strengths are. He's got a lot more strength than me. He's been doing it a little bit longer. And so I really kind of fed into that, where I'm like, look, I'm always going to write about Poltergeist because Poltergeist is like huge for me, but he is the Toby Hooper guy. So like everything else, Toby is all him always. Like, I'm not writing about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre too. That's all him. So it was really fun to be able to kind of like play to our strengths, maybe discover some new movies along the way. And then again, really going to champion like a bunch of different types of movies, because like, you know, in the same breath of like doing Ghost Story or doing Changeling with like George C. Scott, like I'm writing about Maniac and like, you know, one of the most like weirdly sadistic movies of the early 80s, but it's like so influential and it's so good. Or like I'm wearing my Dead and Buried shirt, which is like one of my sort of favorite cult movies, that like a lot of folks may not know about, but like I adore it. Like I love the way Gary Sherman approaches the story. I love that cast, love the special effects from Stan Winston, which was prior to him having like his big Stan Winston studio. This is still pre-Terminator, so he's still kind of doing his thing in a very unique way. So yeah, like it was such a blast to get to like dive into these movies and really just not rehash a bunch of stuff that these fans of the documentaries have already seen. Cause like, if I do that, what's the point? Yeah. You know, that's boring, but that's not me. I'm never gonna do that.
Was there one particular entry that stood out to you that is like you're so happy to bring attention to it for people who had maybe never seen it before? Like anyone at all, even if it was like two, like if it's one that everybody knows, but was there one that just like, oh yeah, I'm so happy we get to feature this. Not a lot of people know it. Anything that come to your mind from the book now?
Yeah, I think the big one for me, and it's a movie that I've spent most of my life championing because it's like, I just love it. Like, so the 80s, we were so lucky to have a lot of really great vampire movies. And I love, love, love vampire movies. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like, you know, you have the people like obviously Lost Boys, big one, huge. It's, you know, it's where it is because it rules so hard. Fright Night was a huge movie for me growing up because it really, like, it just sort of changed my perspective of what horror was at the time. I loved Roddy McDowall. William Ragsdale was like, oh, I love Charlie Brewster so much as a kid. The whole cast is great. The story is great. I feel like over the years, because it's become sort of this like cult, hard to find movie, like Near Dark has sort of found its place. And I'm like, I'm obsessed with Catherine Bigelow. So that's like totally, you know, the thing. But for me, like getting to write about Vamp, which especially now, if anybody watches like The Last Drive-In, like since they showed Vamp, like Joe Bob just bagged on it and like in really big ways. And I was like trying to not personally be offended, but I was personally offended. I was like, what? Like, I forget what we were just watching on the most recent episode where Darcy was like, wait, you're championing this movie, but you were this hard on Vamp, which I think is totally valid because I'm like, for me, Vamp was like one of the best discoveries I had as a kid. Cause I just rented it basically based on the artwork alone. And yeah, it's like a sexy movie with vampires and strippers. We don't have From Dusk Till Dawn without Vamp. But it was like, I loved growing up Chris Makepeace. I was like obsessed with Meatballs was a huge movie for me as a kid. I'm so dating myself. There's like people in their 20s that are like watching this and they're like, what is this old lady talking about?
The treasure trove.
Yeah, Meatballs was like huge when I was a kid. Like Bill Murray, like bunch of like up and coming young talent. Oh, so I loved Chris Makepeace. I adored Getty Watanabe. And what I loved about him in Vamp is that he's not playing a stereotype. And up until that point, I'd only seen him in very stereotypical roles, whether it was 16 Candles or Gung Ho. Good movies definitely haven't aged the greatest, but I really liked him as an actor. So getting him to see him in this and being just a normal rich kid, like, okay, that's cool. Obviously Robert Ressler coming off of like Nightmare 2, Weird Science, like that was pretty cool. And like Grace Jones at that point was like such a phenomenon coming out of like James Bond world. Yeah. I think at that point, yes, she was, cause like the statue that she does her little dance on is actually a body cast of Dolph Lundgren. Like, her and Dolph Lundgren were kind of like the it couple at that point too. And it's just like this wonderful like amalgamation of all these things that I absolutely adore. It's horror comedy. It's sexy. It's got great music. It gives you some unexpected twists. It just kind of keeps coming at you. And but it also like felt like it had a reverence for like the old days, like old, you know, Vegas, where he's like, you know, that's Vegas, that's class, you know? It was to be able to champion Vamp over the years, but then also get to like officially celebrate it here in this book in like some sort of an official way. I was like, yes, like this is a dream come true. So it was like just getting those little opportunities. That was like probably the movie. So like years ago, like after I did the first year of the festival, like the second year we lost the theater, but we still did stuff at Elric, who is on Colors of the Dark podcast. He used to have a cafe in LA called Jump Cut. And so they would do screenings and events and stuff. So I actually brought the second year of that festival to Jump Cut, just pared it down, made it really small. So like the first night we showed The Fog and I was able to get John Carpenter out.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, which was like, everyone's like, oh my God, what? So John came out for that. And then the third night we did Hellraiser, and I actually got to surprise everybody with Doug Bradley because he was in town doing a convention, but we couldn't announce him because he had like a no compete with the convention. So we snuck him over. But in between that, on a Saturday night, we got to show Vamp. And I'd gotten friendly with Robert Russler. And I was like, I just want to do this. I want to celebrate. I love New World Pictures. Like, this to me was like the quintessential New World Pictures movie of the 80s. And he was like, I got you. We're going to do this. And so he was able to like pull it together. We're like, we got the director, Richard Wenk, out. Edie Pfeiffer showed up. Producer Donald Borchers, who was a hugely instrumental figure at New World Pictures at that time, came out. The editor was there. It was like a dream come true. Like, so Donald brought me like an original one sheet. It was just like magic. And so like, it was just kind of like, getting to write about it now, like, felt like everything kind of came full circle. And I was like, yeah, like, somebody out there might actually go watch this movie because I wrote about it. I hope they do. Like, I Vamp, for me, I love it so much. Like, it just, it's one of those I have to shut myself up now because I will just ramble on about Vamp for another 30 minutes. And we have wrestling this afternoon, so we can't do that.
That's right. Oh, man, that's coming. Which, speaking of, and we're going to get there. So we're getting towards the end of it here. And I'm curious, with all the articles, the reviews, the podcasts, the film festivals, you know, your time doing all of this had to be like such a fun, glorious grind. You know, I'm sure there obviously weren't the best of times with it as well, too. But what advice would you give to like the next generation of creators that are looking to lend their voice to this world? Because, you know, what you've accomplished is impressive. And you've talked a lot about how like the space has definitely changed in your, you know, over the years here. What advice would you pass on to those who are looking to enter this kind of world as well, too?
Hey everybody, thank you so much for checking out part 2 of my interview with Heather Wixon. Make sure to hit that subscribe button because the conclusion part 3 is going to go up to my channel tomorrow. And right now you can go and purchase the book that she has co-written with Patrick Bromley, In Search of Darkness, A Definitive Guide to 80s Horror, right now at aminkpublishing.com. As well, you can go and check out the In Search of Darkness documentary series on Amazon Prime right this moment. Get Shudder so you can go and see that there. But go get the book, go watch the documentary, and hit that subscribe button because I'm going to be back here with the conclusion of my interview with Heather Wixon tomorrow on the channel, folks. My name is T. We've been talking scary movies. Stay scared.
Boy here is a big fan of Fangoria. So if you want to check out the world's best horror magazine that's out there, get a chance to get yourself your own subscription, which I just got my first one back in 2022, and I don't regret it for a second. But if you want your own Fangoria subscription, or you like the Fangoria merchandise, then head over to the Fangoria shop and use my link if you wanna save yourself some money, folks. That's an easy one to remember. Just go to shop.fangoria.com/AXDEW. Again, that's shop.fangoria.com/AXDEW, or use my specific code AXDEW at checkout. You can save 20% off your entire order, and that implies 2 subscription and one-time orders as well. You don't want to miss out, folks, because with the magnitude of horror movies we've had released in the last few years, and with what we have on the horizon, Fangoria is going to be your number one source for all that great, juicy, bloody information in the world of horror. So again, head to shop.fangoria.com. Hey there, folks. Thanks for tuning in to T-Watch This Scary Movie. I appreciate you checking out another review or movie news, whether we're talking movies, TV shows, books, or games, whatever. It's all scary. Remember, you can check out new episodes every Wednesday night at 8:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on the YouTube page for video. That's youtube.com/C/TheronReynoldsScaryMovie. Again, youtube.com/C/TheronReynoldsScaryMovie. And you can check out the audio version on all your favorite podcasting platforms. Just search T Watch the Scary Movie or TWAZA. Don't forget, my name is T. We've been talking scary movies. Stay scared.